Hello everybody and welcome back to another week at the Damage Report. I'm John Adirola, and it being Monday and all, Brooke Thomas also.
I'm here, yeah, hi.
Good to have you here.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
How was your weekend, Brooke?
It was good. It was relaxing, had a little fun.
Yeah?
Yeah, I went to this like fun event. HBO has this new, initiative out, and it's called like Our Stories, but it's all about like black culture and like content and cool stories and kind of highlighting those stories. It was a really cool event.
And you got to go to the event.
Yeah,
look
and I got
at
a free
you,
sweatshirt.
Tapped in.
I got a free sweatshirt. That was the coolest thing about
that's awesome.
The event.
Yeah, Our Story is also Our Sweatshirts. That's awesome. Man, look at you, HBO inviting you
to
events.
It was fun. Yeah, so I had a good weekend.
Awesome. That's cool. I mostly watch TV.
Yeah?
The Mandalorian, check it out. I'm not saying you should get the service or whatever,
because
we don't have a sponsorship by them.
Oh, yeah.
But the show is good at the very least. Baby Yoda, very cute. I'll just say that. So anyway, that was how my weekend went.
Old Yoda is very cute.
Yeah, he is actually. Yeah, and both, I'm just gonna say this, they both look like Bernie Sanders. Is that a coincidence? I don't know. But anyway, this gives you an idea of our lives.
I'm not sure what to do.
She goes to real events. I watch TV and occasionally have my phone go off.
Do we have a sponsorship for
no idea how that went off.
Bootleg version of Siri over there?
Oh.
You know how I feel about your phone.
She's gonna respond because she apparently has no filter.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Dorothy.
But anyway, I don't know how we recover. I don't know if you saw the last episode that Brett was on. We hit a road bump. This might be worse. But anyway, you know what we're gonna do? We have a lot to fit in,
okay.
Busy show. I will just say Nina Turner will be joining us a little bit later on. So with that, why don't we jump into the first big news story of the day. Donald Trump's impeachment inquiry. The public hearings of the end of last week were pretty fiery. A lot came out there. I actually expect more on Wednesday when Gordon Sondland testifies. That's gonna be a big day. But how did the weekend shows react to what was revealed? Well, Chris Wallace got into it with Steve Scalise. And Trump was not a big fan of that interview. But let's first talk about some of their back and forth. And it had to do with who was actually on that original call that was revealed. Who knows what was truly going on? Take a look.
There were only two people that participated in that phone call. It was Donald Trump and President Zelensky. Both of them were very happy with the phone call. Zelensky said there was no pressure.
Sure, a half dozen.
And the real bottom line is he got the money. Got the money,
well,
Chris.
First of all, a dozen people listened in on the phone call, and a number of them were immediately upset because what the president said about Burisma.
Well, those were ship's witnesses.
They're career Foreign Service officers, and these are people who worked in the Trump administration.
Ship's witnesses. There are other witnesses.
You had a woman yesterday. You had a woman yesterday who was on Vice President Pence's staff. She said it was inappropriate. You had Tim Morrison, who was on the NSC staff, who said that alarm bells immediately went off for him. Alexander Vindman immediately went to see. These are all people. You say they're ship's witnesses. They all were working in the Trump administration. But let me get back to my.
They were not all Trump administration folks.
What, are you saying that the person working, Alexander Vindman, wasn't part of the Trump
General
National Security Council?
The foreign minister of Ukraine just came out a few days ago to clear some of this up to say there was never a link between
the money. He incidentally was not on the call either.
Yeah, so there were only two people on the call, even though we know there were far more. And the reason we know that was because so many of them had an issue with it. But those people don't count because they're just Schiff's witnesses, even though they'd been hired by Donald Trump to fill multiple different areas of the State Department, the NSC, all of that. And then he goes back to, well, actually, there's this foreign minister, but that guy wasn't even on the call. And you were just saying we should only listen to the people who were on the call.
Everyone is in Kellyanne Conway cosplay. Like that's what this call has turned everyone into. But this is that interview that we just saw, that clip. We've seen the same thing 45 times now.
Yeah.
45 different people saying what's there is not there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's I worry that we're in such a partisan time that a Republican can watch that and think, yeah, Steve Scalise, he's being intellectually honest and fair. I don't know how you could think that, but probably some people will. The idea that you can discount all of these people, some of whom were hired to come on to work for Trump after being begged to fill positions that were only vacant because they had forced out people that they considered insufficiently loyal to the president. All of those people are just Schiff's witnesses. What does that talking point even mean? I know what it means, that they're no longer Republicans or something.
But none
he
of them
says
are
Schiff's
logic.
Witnesses. Trump says they're face. Never Trumpers when they literally were working for Donald Trump.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But there was a little bit more. in terms of Scalise's effort to confuse you about what was actually revealed last week. Here you go.
Let's talk in reality. Why don't we look at the three witnesses who actually did testify this week? All three of them were asked by, whether it was John Ratcliffe or whether it was Chris Stewart, all three of them were asked, did you see any impeachable offenses? Did you see any bribery? Any of that? Not one of those things were mentioned. Not one person said they saw a crime committed.
Sir, with all due respect, that very badly mischaracterizes what they said. They were asked, William Taylor, for instance, the acting ambassador in Ukraine, was asked whether or not these were impeachable offenses. He said, I'm there as a fact witness. I'm not there to pass judgment. But he made it clear what he thought about what the president was doing. Here he is.
To withhold that assistance for no good reason other than help with the political campaign made no sense. It was counterproductive to all of what we had been trying to do. It was illogical. It could not be explained. It was crazy.
He said withholding military aid to help with the president's political campaign was crazy.
And the problem with that is it didn't happen, Chris.
And they had multiple back and forths where, because Gordon Sondland is going to testify on Wednesday, Chris Wallace was trying to say, so if Gordon Sondland says that there was a quid pro quo, then will that mean something to you? And he kept evading the question, saying, I'm not going to answer hypotheticals, even though this is a hypothetical for 3 days from now, or actually 2 days from now, three days from when it was asked.
We're going to get the new memory or the old memory on Wednesday.
Who knows? I mentioned that on my live video today. And the thing is, Scalise kept saying, I don't want people with third or fourth hand information, when literally nobody has fourth hand information. That's a lot of hands. But he's saying, I want people who had direct knowledge. And so Chris Wallace cuts in and says, aha, well, Gordon Sondland talked to Trump and talked to Zelensky. He has firsthand knowledge. Will that then, according to your definition, be something you will trust? And Scalise says, I'll trust what Trump says.
They are all.
So it's all fake standards that they're setting up. They don't mean any of it.
They're all pushing this talking point that it can only be withheld if it's permanent. That the definition of the word is now means permanent.
So you're saying for the aid.
Uh-huh.
And because they eventually got it,
then it
even though they got
withheld.
It 2 days after the whistleblower revealed everything.
And it's just, you can't argue with grass.
Uh-huh.
You know.
I haven't heard that expression, but I like it and I get it. By the way, in terms of in the earlier clip, him saying, well, you know, Zelensky said they didn't feel any pressure. The AP is reporting today, Zelensky had a meeting with multiple aides trying to figure out how he can get through this difficult political situation because he doesn't want to be seen to be taking sides in the 2020 election. So Zelensky can say, I didn't feel any pressure. It's apparently a lie. He was having meetings where he was talking about how much pressure he felt and trying to figure out a strategy for dealing with it. And I will just say one other thing. I know that, like, because of all the talk about the lack of pizzazz last week, mm-hmm. that the mainstream media is like, well, we don't want to seem too excited about this impeachment, so we're going to pretend that nobody cares about it. 70% of Americans think that his request to a foreign leader to investigate his rival was wrong. A slim majority, 51%, believe that his actions were both wrong and he should be impeached and removed from office. 19% more don't necessarily think he should be removed from office, but think he should probably be impeached. Only 25% of the country think that Trump did nothing wrong. That is smaller, by the way, than his historic base, the most concrete always Trumpers has ever been. Only 25% think, no, it's totally cool what he did. Still sad for America, by the way.
Yeah.
But anyway, Trump not a fan of that interview. He was tweeting about it earlier, weirdly attacking Chris Wallace, saying he'll never be like his father. Dude, you're just projecting that you feel like you haven't lived up to your father's example or whatever. I don't know. But anyway, this is a sort of a catch up from the weekend. Lots more to come this week when Gordon Sondland testifies again. Although I share your concerns, will it be the original Gordon Sondland or the one who was apparently feeling pressure to have his testimony comport with what other people are revealing?
Right, what a mess, all right.
Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, The host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
The right has a new strategy going into the 2020 elections that they've already debuted in one gubernatorial election to get people scared about the transgender community. Take a look at an ad that ran in the Kentucky governor's race.
All any athlete wants is a fair shot in competition. To play by the rules. To show how hard work pays off and how champions are made. But what if the rules change? If Andy Beshear gets his way, there won't be any rules. Anyone at any time can change teams for any reason. Beshear calls this equality. But is it fair? Vote against Andy Beshear. He's too extreme for Kentucky.
Joining us to comment, Zeke Stokes. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thanks so much for having me, John. I really appreciate it.
We're very glad to have you on. And we should mention that ad ran in an election that the Democrat did end up winning, but it could potentially be a preview of what this American Principles Project is going to be doing in other races. What did you think about their attempt to take down Andy Beshear on that issue?
Well, you know, we've seen this so many times before in political races around the country, and it really does, I think, demonstrate just how morally and politically bankrupt the Republican Party is. But we can't, I don't think, discount these kinds of attacks. It was a really close race in Kentucky. There were a lot of things at play there, including a Republican governor that wasn't all that popular with his own Republican base. This is a playbook we've seen for a generation from the Republicans, generations, in fact. They do it on race. They do it on immigration. They do it to Muslims. They do it on guns. It's all about fear. And this is a strategy that they've employed before that we've seen work in many cases, and we may see work again. And we have to be incredibly vigilant when we look to places like Michigan, where a few votes made a very big difference in 2016. Just 10,000 votes, Trump won the state by. A few voters who are receiving fear and not facts from the other side can make a big difference. And so we have to be incredibly vigilant. So I'm worried when I see reports that Democrats aren't spending enough on digital ads and the places where people are really seeing these kinds of damaging and dangerous messages.
Well, you know, on this particular issue, we had Parker Malloy of Media Matters on a few months back to talk about how, there's been attacks against the transgender community from the right, but they really do seem to be focusing these days on the sports thing. They're suddenly interested in high school and college women's sports in a way that they never have been before, supposedly because of this ever-present threat that men are going to simply decide one day that like they want to pretend that they're transgender. And it's my belief that that has never actually happened, that that's actually not an issue in these sports. But why do you think it is that they're focusing on this area now?
You know, I think if these were well-intended people, we might just say this is a solution in search of a problem, but it's so much more than that. They tried this in 2014 and 2016 after we saw the passage of marriage equality as sort of their next stand. It was going to be the transgender community, and so they started going around this bathroom message that bathrooms weren't going to be safe. We saw the state of North Carolina pass a draconian law around bathrooms and transgender protections, and we saw the backlash around that. The governor of North Carolina was defeated because of that. So we saw that not work. working. And we saw states like Texas and others saying no to that kind of legislation. So now that hasn't worked. So they're going to the next depth, which is this idea that somehow there's this epidemic of boys who want to play on girls' teams in college and high school and vice versa. And it simply doesn't exist. It's all about scaring parents to believe that there's going to be somebody in the locker room who's a threat to their kid. And it's simply not true.
Hey Zeke, so how do we push back against this? Because there obviously hasn't been, as John mentioned, like the same sort of passion when it comes to women's sports. A lot of these same people are still arguing that the US women's soccer team shouldn't be paid the same as the men. None of these people are, you know, speaking out about equality when it comes to women's sports versus men's sports. And so it's very see-through. Mm-hmm. And how do we, as you know, the public, push back against this?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is make sure that progressives are registered and ready to go vote this year. I just saw a study from our own LGBTQ community that indicates that one in every five LGBTQ people is not registered to vote. And again, when you go to a state like Michigan and you look at the 10,000 vote differential there for Trump that put him over the top in 2016, there are 76,000 unregistered and unvoting LGBTQ people just in the state of Michigan. Our vote alone could change some of these battleground states. And when you extrapolate that to other marginalized communities, women, people of color, immigrants, the Muslim community, others who've been attacked by this administration, the power is in our hands. And unfortunately, there's not much else we can do at this point except go defeat these folks at the ballot box.
You know, as we pointed out, that attempt to take down Andy Beshear, he narrowly won. Although, as you say, there were many factors playing into that. But it's likely that the American Principles Project is not done running ads, and they're probably going to get involved in both the primaries and the general election coming up in 2020. What do we know about this organization so that people going into this election, when they see this group behind ads, they might know, you know, where it's coming from?
Sure thing. You know, this is part of a big orchestrated, connected network of right-wing organizations. Organizations like Focus on the Family, and Tony Perkins, and the same players that we've seen before, 1 million so-called moms, which really is, you know, just a few old white guys in an office somewhere in Texas, claiming to speak for moms. It's an orchestrated movement that. It rears its head every couple of years with a new name, a new tax status, but they're all doing exactly the same thing. They're shadowy groups. They're made up and funded by anonymous donors that want to turn the clock back on the progress that progressives and marginalized communities have made over the last couple of decades. So, you know, I think you can expect organizations like GLAAD and others to really be doing their due diligence and uncovering who these people are, who they're funded by, what their real agenda is. We know it's not a pro-family agenda. It's an anti-American, anti-LGBT agenda, and we're going to all have to be on the lookout and educating ourselves and each other about what the real agenda of organizations like this are. And in a time when Facebook and others are allowing unfettered access to the public space without the protection of fact checking, it's unfortunately incumbent upon all of us to do the fact checking for them.
I couldn't agree more. Zeke Soak, as always, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I want to take a short break here. When we come back, Bill Barr, AG, had a speech over the weekend that you really need to see. William Barr is the Attorney General. That means he is the chief law enforcement officer for the American people, for the American government. But unfortunately, in his time as AG, he seems to think that his position is intended to accomplish a far more partisan set of goals. And his loyalty to the president goes beyond anything the AG is supposed to have traditionally. Take a look at some excerpts from a speech that he gave to the Federalist Society. And remember that he is saying this just hours after yet another one of Trump's aides was convicted of multiple counts of lying to Congress and witness tampering. He had this to say. Immediately after President Trump won election, opponents inaugurated what they called the resistance, and they rallied around an explicit strategy of using every tool and maneuver to sabotage the functioning of the executive branch and his administration. The fact of the matter is that in waging a scorched earth, no holds barred war of resistance against this administration, it is the left that is engaged in the systemic shredding of norms and undermining the rule of law. And so the AG is taking the entirety of the left and attacking it at the Federalist Society. He goes on to criticize Democrats for launching what he calls a holy war and using, quote, any means necessary to gain momentary advantage, while he said conservatives, quote, tend to have more scruple over their political tactics and rarely feel that the ends justify the means. And that's why they would never impeach a president over oral sex.
I thought that his position was supposed to be non-political.
It is supposed to be non-political.
Okay, so we're just not even faking it
anymore. Or nonpartisan at the very least. It's political, but he's not supposed to identify closely with one ideology or party and see himself as launching a war against the other side, which he clearly does.
Yeah, we're not even faking it anymore.
No.
Yeah, that's all right.
Yeah, okay. Well, look, he went on to say, in any age, the so-called progressives treat politics as their religion. Their holy mission is to use the coercive power of the state to remake man and society in their own image, according to an abstract ideal of perfection. That's just crazy. That's like right-wing radio host commentary there, but he is an incredibly powerful officer in the US government who says that the progressives, by the way, are just so-called progressives. They're actually practicing a religion and going on a holy war. I love the projection there that the people who he literally in a speech a couple of months ago attacked radical secularists. On the one hand, the radical secularists. On the other hand, they're the true jihadis who are launching a holy war. And William Barr, who is an incredibly religious person who wants to see Christianity embedded more closely in American government, is attacking the left as supposedly following a religion. And that's a thing that comes up a lot, by the way. The really religious right loves to pretend that they're totally non-religious. It's in fact the left who are pursuing some sort of religion.
This is disheartening. But I mean, the thing is that we're jokingly saying, like, I thought he was supposed to be non-political. I thought his position was, of course, that we passed that point a long time ago. He's been seemingly acting as the president's personal attorney.
Yeah.
So we passed that point a long time ago. It's just fascinating that he's so loudly going for it.
And I don't know for sure that this is due to the impeachment strategy that the Democrats are going for, where it's very narrowly defined over just one issue, the Ukraine thing, and a very narrow sort of section of that. But I've been saying over and over that William Barr should be a part of that conversation. He tried to shut down the investigation. He's the reason the whistleblower's initial raising concerns didn't go anywhere. And yet he's off giving speeches of the Federalist Society and doing whatever he wants. He's not tapped into this at all. It's not just that he's not testifying, it's that there's not even calls for him to testify. The Democrats seem to have completely forgotten about him. And not only has he had this effect in the Ukraine scandal of trying to protect the president, but we know that when the Mueller report was coming out, he had his little press release where he gave a very disingenuous version of what it was going to reveal. And yet nothing is being done. The Democrats seem to believe, you know what? It's fine. We've got bigger fish to fry. The AG, who holds immense power over a number of different issues, not all of them related to Donald Trump, but we know very important when it comes to criminal justice across the country, drug policy, all of these things. Is this the guy you trust on those issues?
If you're Donald Trump, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. But we should expect more. And I don't know why nothing is being done.
Right.
Yeah. As you said, disheartening. Okay. With that, why don't we move on to the crazy news of the day? North Korean state media launched an attack for some reason against Joe Biden that went a little bit crazy. And Donald Trump somehow came out of this looking crazier than North Korea. So look, they wrote about him and they misspelled Biden's name, to be fair. But KCNA said the former vice president was showing signs of, quote, the final stage of dementia, and that, quote, time has come for him to depart his life. Some of that may be lost in translation, but the idea that he should die is definitely there. And apparently they took issue with something that he had said that was critical of Kim Jong-un. They didn't cite exactly what it was, but they didn't like that supposedly Biden had attacked their leader. And so they go on to say it was the last ditch efforts of the rabid dog expediting his death. Rabid dogs like Biden can hurt lots of people if they're allowed to run about. They must be beaten to death with a stick before it is too late. And with all of that being reported and people tweeting out that article, Donald Trump quote retweeted one of those saying, "Mr. Chairman, Joe Biden may be sleepy and very slow, but he is not a rabid dog. He is actually somewhat better than that, but I am the only one who can get you where you have to be. You should act quickly, get the deal done, see you soon." And by the way, the beaten to death with a stick part is in the thing that he retweeted, and he said, "See you soon."
I don't know what to do with any piece of that.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that bizarre? Like, they're not directly threatening to kill Biden, but they're saying that somebody should kill him violently. And the current president, who will be potentially facing Joe Biden,
when you responds say someone with, should be killed, mm-hmm. I don't think you get to step away and say, "Well, I'm not saying I'll kill him." I think they're about even.
They're about even. And so his response is, hey, you're being a little bit too hard on Biden. I think you've gone a little bit far. He's sleepy and all. And look, this is the sort of thing we don't even really normally report on these anymore, because what do you do about it? Mm-hmm. But it will be nice when we get back to a point where we don't have the current president being like cool and like, you know, like friendly when people threaten to murder US politicians.
And what was even the point of that?
From the North Koreans' point of view? I don't know.
Right. Okay.
They have to fill a lot of time, I guess.
Is that okay?
Well, and also, like, conceivably, if Biden was being critical of him, they definitely have to be to put up a strong defense.
Okay.
It's expected of them in state media. Same principle working with Fox News. So anyway, I don't know what you're supposed to do with this information.
It's the weirdest.
But that's an official tweet that is in the congressional record now, because it's an official communication from the president.
And not the worst one.
No, probably not. Yeah. No, the crocodiles thing is probably still worse. Okay, with that, we are going to take a break. We come back. Nina Turner is going to be joining us to break down a new initiative of the Bernie campaign. We'll have that and more after this. Bernie Sanders has a new initiative coming up, and I'm very excited to learn more about it with our next two guests. Nina Turner, national co-chair for the Bernie 2020 campaign and former state senator, joining us once again, as well as Philip Agnew, national surrogate for Bernie. Welcome to the show, to both of you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you for having us.
Great to have you back. Nina, I feel like we haven't talked in like 6 days.
I hear Brooke laughing at me.
So, Bernie's got this new HBCU organizing initiative coming up. Tell us about it.
Well, we're here traveling across the South to HBCUs, just really affirming the senator's commitment and recognition of the unique space that historically Black colleges and universities occupy. We are here at the great University
Tennessee State.
And really happy to be here. And Philip Agnew, uniquely, he is a product of an HBCU. So I want to get him to jump in here right away.
Well, you know, this is a part of our enduring commitment to making sure that Black students rightfully occupy their place in the democratic process. We're the only campaign that has a dedicated resource organizing campaign that is directed towards HBCU students. And for me, as a graduate of them, I know the importance of them in not only the culture and the educational infrastructure, but in guiding and directing the political agenda for young Black people for the next generation. So this is exciting. We're going around the South, and we're going to hit a number of schools this time and be at a number throughout the year.
And John and Brooke, we're doing listening tours. So we're listening to what the college students have to say. We're doing pop-ups. So we just really want them to know that Senator Sanders, one, cares about what they have to say, understands, again, the unique positioning of HBCUs, and has a plan to ensure that HBCUs get the type of support and dollars that they need and deserve.
Well, why don't we start with the listening? So as you're going around and you're talking with these students, what are some of the big issues or concerns that they're raising? You know, in what areas are there overlap with some of the big national conversations? And in what areas are there perhaps concerns that aren't being talked about nationally?
Lots of overlap.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so we're just leaving a listening session here at Tennessee State. Student loans, healthcare, housing,
guns, immigration,
criminal justice. These are, you know, the issues of black people, especially young black students. We are part of the American body politics. So the issues are not going to be different. But what is different is we want to know that we have a leader that is coming into office that understands the impact of these issues, specifically and many times disproportionately in black communities and Latino communities and poor white communities. And we have a leader, obviously, that does that. But also, we want to make sure that people understand that this is a campaign that does listen, mm-hmm. right? We don't just talk. We don't just put out policies. The policies that we put out are based on not only listening, but being hands-on with the very communities that are going to be affected by the policy and the development of it and the impact of it.
So thinking back to 2016, so you've got the substantive concerns that you're going around and you're learning about, but strategically for the campaign in 2016, Bernie did very well in some of the early states, but on Super Tuesday, his performance in some of the southern states wasn't amazing. And there's a concern that some of the support from black voters just wasn't there for Bernie. So what are some of the ways that the campaign is adapting, especially as you're going around to these colleges with younger voters to help him perform better in some of these southern states in 2020?
Well, John, as we know, it was Senator Sanders' first time running for president. He's a senator from Vermont by way of Brooklyn. I always got to shout out Brooklyn. You know, so he was, you know, people were getting to know him all across this country, but particularly in the African American community. And we know that when we hit South Carolina, where the voting base is more diverse, you know, this time you are going to see a difference. There's already a difference right now. Senator had less than, you can count on one hand, the number of endorsers that he had coming out of South Carolina. Right now, we got 25 endorsers coming out of South Carolina. 9 of them are members of the state legislature. And 21 of that number are African Americans. That in and of itself is light years ahead of where he was then. And then in terms of 2016, we all know that the senator did very well with the millennial generation across race and ethnicity. So the very types of people that we're talking to on these college campuses, those are the folks who were rocking with Senator Sanders in 2016. And we believe that they're gonna rock with him again in 2019, well into 2020. And the polling indicates that Senator Sanders, in terms of the vision that younger people want to see for this nation, they believe that Senator Bernard Sanders' vision for this nation is the one that is gonna catapult us to the next level in this country.
Hey, you guys, good morning. I'm glad that we're highlighting HBCUs because obviously, like a lot of HBCUs in this country are struggling. And as we know, most black doctors, lawyers, judges are products of HBCUs. And that's incredibly important to our country. And you mentioned listening, and John mentioned what we saw the last time around. I want to know, like, as far as like feedback, are these students, like, do they feel, what are you hearing? Are they feeling seen and heard? And what's the feedback you're getting just from being there?
So when I mentioned that I went to and graduated from an HBCU, it's not just to say that's what I did. It's because this is the water that I swim in. My current network is made up of alumni of HBCUs. What we hear from them, what we just heard today, is that there is no campaign speaking directly to HBCU students, not in the way that we are. On the whole, they're not feeling heard. They're not feeling listened to. And that's one of the reasons why we developed a dedicated program to be there. You know, HBCU students, there's 101 HBCUs, almost 300,000 students that currently attend them. But we also have the alumni networks, the fraternal and sorority networks who form the scaffolding for most black communities right now. And that is why we are here. That is why we're going to Alabama State. That is why we're going to Tuskegee. That's why we're going to be in Atlanta. Specifically because of that reason. No one has been talking directly to them in the way that we have. And it, you know, sometimes it hurts to be the first because you're hearing from students right now, the conversation we just left, that they're not being adequately talked to. But that is the work that it takes to bring them into the body politic. That is the work that it takes to make sure that they go into the White House with Senator Sanders. And that's the work that we're doing.
And Brooke, to add to what Agnew just said, I mean, the students here at Tennessee State, they made it very clear they were excited that we're here.
Yep.
First campaign to come on this campus, I mean, to the university, they're just really excited. And they get a chance to express their hopes, their dreams, their fears, and their vision for a better quality of life for them, their families, and for future generations. Agnew, neither one of us are wearing one of our HBCU shirts, but something I want to point out that we talked about, our shirt says, Bernie Sanders for HBCUs,
right,
and not the other way around. Mm-hmm. And that positioning is vitally important, and it sets the foundation and the foundation for what this campaign really is all about, and the commitment that the senator has to HBCUs, both public and private, yeah, HBCUs, yeah, because he does understand their unique position in the universe.
There's one issue I'd like to know if the students are concerned about, and that is voter suppression, because it sounds like students at an HBCU, there's probably no one in the country that's more a target for efforts to make sure that it's difficult for them to vote, that there's as many obstacles as possible. I mean, they're both young college students and black, all three are targets, you know, in Tennessee, in the Deep South, in many parts of the country. So are there concerns about these impediments or obstacles to voting going into the 2020 election?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in North Carolina, a number of states, in Florida as well, we have voting locations that were on our campus, and those started to be systematically removed. It's absolutely a concern of young people and young black students at these campuses that they're able to vote, that early voting stays open. I want to also highlight something else. We equally as important as having access to the ballot is access to the truth and real information about what is being discussed from politicians and their politics. And that is something that we're also hearing very, very consistently, that they don't feel they can trust anybody, let alone the debate stage, to get the information that they need that is accurate, that is truthful, that shows the impacts of what these policies are gonna do. And so that's what it takes, not just people fighting for the right and the access to the franchise, but also to the relevant information that is required to make sure there's power when they go into the ballot box, that power of knowledge and information. So we're hearing it over and over. The access has been diminished across the South. That's why social movements exist. That's why Sanders has been championing almost really universal access to the ballot box, including day off, a holiday on election day. And students are excited to hear that and excited about the prospects of returning not only political discourse, but political power to HBCUs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Nina Turner, Philip Agnew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, thank John. Thanks, Brooke.
Thank you.
We're taking a short break here and come back just a little bit more to close out the show. So that is a musical number that is not problematic in any way. No, that seriously was in a Disney movie. You can still see scenes like that on the newly launched Disney Plus, but there's a warning beforehand saying that these are cultural depictions that are of their time, which is another way of saying, man, you could get away with a lot of really blatant racism.
Right, it's like, hey, we weren't listening to marginalized communities back then, even less than we are now.
Like there was nobody within a mile of those animation studios that thought that's really bad.
Because that was still racist back then. It was still racist. It's just the people who that hurt didn't have as loud of a voice.
Mm-hmm. Or any voice.
Forced, or any voice, you weren't forced to listen. And I hate that whole like, oh, things were different back then. No, they were not.
No, that was awful. That was awful then.
That was awful then.
It was.
You just didn't care a little less than you, like, it's just, I don't know. But
you were just so overwhelmingly powerful that you didn't have to give 1/10 of a damn.
And the thing is, the warning is good. I don't think wipe all the cartoons out. The warnings are good. It's just worded bad.
Yeah, so I get what you're saying, but I was watching Fox News and they think this is actually bad to warn people about. So let's go to Laura Ingraham's show.
Before you watch certain classic Disney films, Laura, Disney is posting warnings like this one for Dumbo.
What?
This program is presented as originally created. It may contain outdated cultural depictions.
About the elephant?
No. That's a reference to the black crows. Remember, they kind of use those minstrelly accents in the film. They smoke cigars. There are other warnings as well.
Warnings?
Beware of those Siamese cats in Lady and the Tramp and an Asian cat playing piano with chopsticks in The Aristocats. And Tiger Lily and her daddy in Peter Pan, all old cultural
depictions. Can I say,
I bet apologized for.
Literally no one ever noticed any of this.
Nobody.
But now people are going to be looking, oh, what does that armadillo look like?
Here's the good news. The good news is they didn't cut these classic films.
Not yet.
They're leaving them as cultural touchstones. Explain to kids why this is out of favor, or we don't talk that way anymore, or this is disrespectful to a certain race or a group of people. They can do that. But don't mangle, cut the work. Let people see it as it was originally envisioned.
When are they going to start worrying about the, you know, the beleaguered conservative Christian class? Like, what? When do they go to get their apologies and their changes and their warnings? This is actually offensive to Christians.
Okay, I am no fan of Laura Ingraham, but she raises a good point. No one had ever noticed those stereotypes before.
Like, the crow's name is Jim Crow. Get out of here.
That's a coincidence.
So absurd.
In the crow community, Jim is a very common name. Yes. Nobody thought of I didn't even know about the chopsticks and the piano. That's crazy. And obviously the depictions of Native Americans is, that's crazy. Those, by the way, aren't even the most racist. There was one movie that they're not going to put on. They put on all the rest, but they're not going to be offering the 1946 film Song of the South, which has been criticized for racist depictions of black people and its ill-considered representation of slavery. The NAACP said in a statement that, quote, it regrets, however, that in an effort neither to offend audiences in the North or South, the production helps to perpetuate a dangerously glorified picture of slavery. The film unfortunately gives the impression of an idyllic master-slave relationship, which is a distortion of facts. So that's the one. But for the rest, Laura Ingraham is not a straight news person. I get that. She does opinion. But how can you say nobody had noticed those things?
Because that is the space she swims in.
But she's also just lying.
Right.
You're lying that you know nobody noticed that.
What is there to complain about? They went on this long rant about, like, don't mangle that. That didn't happen. They put a little sentence there.
Beforehand.
A little sentence that also is written in a way as to not offend people like Laura. Because the sentence is wrong. It's not outdated. It was racist back then. It's racist now. And okay.
When it never says that it's racist.
That's how safe it is. Yeah, let these be teaching examples for kids. A lot of people, you know, still love the films. And let's leave them up there because we made a lot of money. And let's talk about these. That's fine. That's fine with me.
Mm-hmm.
Totally fine with
me. Okay, well, look how reason. I think it would be fine if they cut it.
I don't see what she was so mad about. It's just a sentence.
We know what she's mad about. She wants the racist stuff in there. Like, I think, okay, if I was watching Lady and the Tramp and all of a sudden they cut, I would be thinking, well, you know, based on the character development, I feel like they need a racist song right about now. And I feel like it's missing some sort of racist song about cats. But she apparently actually thinks that. She thinks, what's the point of watching Dumbo if I don't get to see racist depictions of black people from that time?
Right, like you are in a bad space in your life. If you are so like deeply offended at the prospect of not being able to offend people, I don't want to live there.
And
I
then, of course, the knee jerk, when are they going to worry about the beleaguered conservative? Yeah, because were there tons of stereotypes of like 1940s era conservatives in America? Like dancing around or something? I don't think that happened.
What?
I don't think they had a lot of making fun of Christians at the time.
Who offends Christians? What offends
Nobody
Christians?
Even now wants to offend Christians. That's how worried they are constantly. Anyway, just ridiculous.
I don't understand how like we can't have a sentence in front of Dumbo, but we can like boycott Starbucks because of a Happy Holidays
cup,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was still red.
Yeah, and by the way, some of these you got to go way far back. But there have been some issues more recently that are still up, and you don't have to go that far back. So some social media users were critical that the outdated cultural depictions message wasn't applied to the 1992 animated version of Aladdin or the 2013 adaptation of The Lone Ranger starring Johnny Depp as a Comanche character.
Also,
that was 6 years ago.
Pocahontas is horrific.
Yes.
Okay.
Good songs, but there are some significant issues with that. And they don't have it on that. So Disney has both done just enough to piss off crazy conservatives, but not enough to really come to grips with their past.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you as always for joining me.
Good to have you here. For having me.
Thank you everybody for watching. We will see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.